You are tuned into We Are Queer on WERU Community Radio Station, 89.9 FM in Blue Hill, Maine. We Are Queer highlights the touching experiences from Maine's diverse LGBTQ+ community. From coming out stories to exploring new chapters, WERQ is a voice to the queer people of Maine, building empathy and understanding in our greater community. I'm your host, Olivia Prook, and I use she, her pronouns. This week, I'm interviewing Zoe Albion, who is a scientist working in forestry. In this interview, we talk about the intersection between science and queerness, ambiguity in life, and dreams for a more inclusive, queer-friendly future.
My name is Zoe Albion, also she, her pronouns. I live in Bangor.
So I'm so excited to dive into this conversation today. I like to touch kind of on the past and kind of, you know, those beginning queer journeys. I feel like for every person is really unique. So I'm wondering if we can maybe walk back a little bit back to kind of a younger version of Zoe and maybe what were your first inklings with your identity?
Oh, man. Well, I would like to say upon reflection that they were my deep obsession with overalls as a child. I think that was definitely a sign. Yeah, I am one of those people who did not know I was queer until not quite later in life, but maybe like a little bit later than some other people. I think looking back, there were definitely feelings I had that maybe I could have explored a little more. I think that also it would have been a lot easier if I had queer role models in my life. I believe I knew one queer out adult throughout my childhood. And so that's something I reflect on. But yeah, I began identifying as bisexual in high school. And I think that was just through a process of feeling like I didn't quite feel like I was in the correct box. I wanted to explore my identity. I had these feelings for girls that I realized might be crushes. Previously, I just thought I like really wanted a best friend. And then I got a best friend who happened to be a girl. And I was like, wow, this feels different, actually. So yeah, a lot of awkwardness. So in high school, that kind of cemented as my identity. And it has changed, certainly. I identified as a lesbian for a while. Now I think I would just more broadly describe myself as queer. That's usually my preferred label. But yeah. Yeah, it was quite a wander. That's what I'll say.
Yeah. And so you were kind of mentioning, obviously, you kind of discovered maybe a little bit of that language in high school, but not having really queer role models, what were kind of the tools or aspects you found yourself using to maybe kind of discover other options?
That's a really good question. I definitely took a lot from books in particular. I've always loved to read. There were books that I think I really like latched onto. I like thinking back to so many, I think so many books that had sort of like covert queer characters and then overt queer characters as well. As time went on, I got my hands on Alison Bechdel's, well, everything. And that was really huge for me, not necessarily just to see that like queer adults existed, but also that they could be like smelly and silly and smart and all of these different like amazing facets of life. That was really special for me.
Yeah, absolutely. That makes a lot of sense. And I was just wondering, did you go through like the public school systems or kind of what was your education
like?
Yeah,
I had a mishmash. Let me see here. I actually went to a private school for the first good chunk of my childhood education, and then I switched to public school. My experience with private school was really challenging. I did not thrive socially. I found the experience really difficult. I think that for many reasons, and maybe one of them was that I was queer, even though maybe I didn't know it. I definitely felt like I was a little bit out of place and didn't really fit in with other kids. And then for high school, I went to public school, and that just radically changed my life. I met so many wonderful, like-minded friends, many of whom turned out to be queer later in life. So we kind of like look back on that and smile, and just generally like a lot of great community.
That's awesome. That's great. The only reason I was just asking, because I feel like, you know, so many people sometimes, depending on their education, are introduced to queer ideas or people, and then sometimes totally not. So I was just trying to wonder if like your school was open or kind of mentioned, or if you felt like it was really just through reading where you discovered queer people.
Yeah, I don't recall getting a ton of education about different identities. Although something that I look back on and honestly like really appreciate, and I'm trying to remember exactly what year it was, maybe like 2009, 2010, in like a middle school health class. And I don't even remember the context. I don't remember if we talked about other queer identities, but I remember that the teacher who was teaching the class told us that some people were transgender. And I think that the way she described it was outdated, but in good faith. And it was the first experience I'd ever heard. It was the first time I had ever heard of someone being trans in those words. I had known trans people, and I had even been like aware of some people in my life transitioning, but I had never heard the word transgender. And I really appreciate that now looking back, and I wonder if she had to fight to include that in the curriculum, or even if she did it without, I don't want to get anyone in trouble. Yeah, I wonder if she had to fight to get that in the curriculum, because it was certainly not something I was hearing in other aspects of my life at all.
Mm. Yeah, I think that's a really important point, you know, kind of that, you know, just having access to different ideas is important, but also how sometimes, you know, a teacher or a certain individual might fight a little stronger or maybe have conflict of kind of adding in different ideas into a curriculum. So definitely really cool. I can say if I had any of that sort of in my middle school. So I think that's really cool that at least that teacher maybe exposed those ideas or the language. But I did want to know, because before we were talking a little bit and you mentioned STEM and queerness, and I just felt like maybe we should just jump into the meat of the topic and kind of, obviously your background is a little bit, I don't know quite your background, so maybe with like science, but I'm assuming leans more STEM science related, and I'd love to know how those two intersect for you.
Yes, I am a scientist in the field of forestry, and I have been involved in science for a pretty long time, actually. Going back through high school, I was able to be involved in lab work and some great stuff like that. So I've known that science was my path for a long time. I think it didn't occur to me for a long time that queerness was relevant to science. I heard a lot about how science was relevant to queerness, particularly when people used science to disparage queerness and try and, quote, debunk it. And so it was a long time before I realized that actually there is a lot of queerness in science, and it's a really beautiful thing. I think actually, well, let me say, when I think of queerness in science or queerness in nature or natural history, I feel like there are sort of these two aspects. One of them is the ways in which like nature and science are queer. And it's so true. Like nature is so queer. It's amazing. And then also the ways in which the people doing the science might be queer. And so I'm an example of that second one. I am really proud to be queer in STEM. There is, I think, sort of a growing movement of people who are out and queer and discussing that and like taking up space and advocating for ourselves. And I think it's really important for many reasons, one of which is just that science is a really heavily gate-kept discipline. I think that there are a lot of reasons that people don't become scientists or people don't become involved in science. And a big one can be that they are just barred access because of their identity. Either people don't reach out to them and offer them opportunities, or they might not see themselves represented in science. And that can be a real barrier as well. So it's something that is really, it's something that I'm really conscious of, both the fact that I'm so lucky to be a scientist and a queer person, and also that I can use, that I can take the opportunities that those identities give me and work to make science more accessible.
Hmm. Yeah, just kind of echoing what you said, I totally understand that sort of letting people see themselves in different careers. And science, for sure, I think for a lot of people, you know, can it feel very gatekeepy where only a certain type of person does STEM. So I think it's really great to have like a newer generation see that, you know, anyone can be in STEM. It's not one sort of person. And maybe just because, touching back on something else you mentioned, because I feel like some of our audience would want to know, how is nature so queer? Could you give some examples that maybe could help for, you know, anyone listening?
Commonly given examples of what a lot of people might know as charismatic macrofauna, big animals that are cute and interesting. And so we see behaviors that would be described as queer. In like penguins, for example, there's a very famous example study of seabird. There's a really great Radiolab episode on that. And also, queerness is in so many other parts of nature too. Arthropods can exhibit what we would describe as queer behavior. And by this, I don't just mean like mating behavior, what we would describe as like homosexual mating behavior or bisexual mating behavior. There is also a ton of diversity in what we would consider gendered presentations in animals. There is also a ton of diversity in the morphology, in like the physical characteristics of animals and also plants. There are phenomena. There's also things like gynandromorphy, which when an animal exhibits both, quote, male and female characteristics, there are organisms that multiply by parthenogenesis. There are organisms that just, yeah, there is so much diversity in nature. And I think a lot of it is what we would consider as queer. The one other thing I want to say, in my opinion, one of the most important reasons why the world needs more queer scientists is because in the past, you know, nature has always been queer. And yet, scientists have not documented or published a lot of the ways that that shows up. And some of that historically is genuinely repression. Some of that is just not really recognizing it. And some of it is just having a hard time articulating what they're seeing or counting or measuring or whatever it may be. And for us, for queer scientists, you know, we're able to look at nature, look at science in a different way. And we're able to make connections that maybe other people wouldn't. One thing I want to mention is that recently I've become acquainted with a book called A Little Gay Natural History. It's by Josh Davis, who is at the National Museum in London. And it is literally chock full of examples of queerness in nature, just everything that you could think of. And it was born from his research into the repression of queerness in science. And it's just like a beautiful, validating, amazing book. It has beautiful pictures. It was blurbed by Stephen Fry. Highly recommend. It just came out in the US. So I've been really excited about that lately.
Yeah, just kind of this idea of using science, but also allowing different perspectives to come through science is definitely, I think, advantageous to science as a whole. So it's definitely something that I feel like people who are truly advocates of science would want, you know, to have people of all walks of life go in to strengthen the discipline. But also I was wondering, you know, in your experience with kind of these examples of the world, if they've also given you a sort of peace or comfort, because you've said that sometimes science has been used as a tool to discount queerness or sort of maybe saying it's unnatural. But obviously these other examples are in direct contrast. So I'm just wondering how that interplays for you.
We have science that refutes those claims that queerness is unnatural. For example, I hear people say that homosexuality is unnatural because animals don't do it. Well, we know that animals do it quite a bit. A lot of animals do it. There is not as much research put into this as you can imagine, but I would hazard a guess to say that most animals exhibit some kind of behavior that we might consider homosexual, and definitely lots of behavior that we might indicate as like gender nonconforming or things of that nature. So it's not true. We know that, and I believe that the more, you know, animal behavior and even sometimes plant behavior is and bacteria is researched, the more we're going to be able to say, actually, we've totally debunked that. It's not true.
Yeah, You are tuned into WERU Community Radio Station, and you are listening to We Are Queer. I'm your host, Olivia Peruke, and you're listening to a conversation I'm having with Zoe Albion, who is a scientist working in forestry. Currently, we're discussing how queer behavior can be seen in the natural world and how science supports queerness.
But I think that one of the ways I've been able to kind of bring those two ideas together in my mind is actually more about the ambiguity of science. It took me a long time as a student to realize that science is really not about facts. It's about substantiating evidence and guesses, hypotheses, you know. It's about making arguments in a lot of cases. I really believe that there are very few situations in which science is 100%. And I think that's so true about sexuality, about gender, where, you know, we're not relying on cold facts. There's not, contrary to popular belief, like a test to find out if you're gay, right? This, you know, this is all coming from our lived experiences. And science is all about that kind of experimentation, you know, living in a way. And I think that there's really not a lot of polarization between the two ideas once you get right down to it.
Yeah, I think that is beautifully put, and definitely I definitely like the comparison of the ambiguity, because I think that's so right on, that there's a lot of ambiguity in science and in queerness, and it's definitely something I've learned doing this show and how everyone views it and sees it. And it is kind of like the natural world. It doesn't always make sense. So I don't know. I like how that was put. I really enjoyed that. And I guess kind of wondering maybe just more concretely, like for people who are listening or maybe, you know, aspiring scientists who are also queer, how maybe you've used your queerness or have found community within STEM or have you, and maybe some advice for any young queer scientist hopefuls.
Yeah. I think firstly, understanding that you bring a unique perspective to whatever work you do. And I think this goes for everybody, but, you know, queerness may be a facet of your unique personality, and that enables you to think creatively in ways that other people might not. And it also gives you the opportunity to collaborate with other people who think uniquely and come up with solutions that might be novel, or they might not be novel, but they might be really helpful and based on evidence. And there is a lot of opportunity for collaboration in science, which is another thing that I really love about it. I also think that queer people in many cases have experienced this feeling of being different. And in science, it can be really a strength to recognize difference and to explore it. And this is something that I've really enjoyed doing in the work that I've done. And I think a lot of people get into science because they have curiosity. And I think that queer people are really primed for curiosity and exploration. We've already done that work within ourselves, and we know that the process is ongoing and iterative. And I think that my thoughts for people who are curious about science and are queer or even are not queer would just be to follow your curiosity, because there is so much to learn, and it doesn't matter what you're curious about as long as you're curious about something.
Aw, that's very sweet. I like that a lot. Both my parents are scientists, so you're just kind of speaking my language. Well, or what I grew up with. But I think just kind of winding down, I guess a little bit of, I guess we could talk a little bit about Bangor, Maine, and how maybe being queer, how you've seen it. I guess maybe, when did you move to Maine?
So I am extremely new to Maine. I moved here last July. I have a connection from childhood to Maine. My mom grew up here, and I visited her family quite a lot in my childhood, coming up 95 with fair regularity. I grew up in New Hampshire. And I really wasn't sure what to expect when I moved to Maine regarding queerness. I had heard that all the queer people were in Portland and there were no queer people anywhere else, which of course is deeply untrue. I have really, really enjoyed meeting people in the queer community here and otherwise. Yeah, I know that Bangor has some really strong and interesting queer history. I definitely need to learn more. I believe there was a lesbian bar in Bangor for a while, which I'm very disappointed I won't be able to go to. But I will say that I have been to a lot of prides, and this past year, going to Bangor Pride was such a beautiful experience. I cried like four times. I think that Maine, and specifically non-Portland Maine, maybe like areas outside of Southern Maine, have the reputation for some people of being unfriendly to queer people and unsafe. And I don't want to say that they're totally friendly and totally safe, because I know that they're not. And I certainly don't want to invalidate the experiences of people who have had bad experiences in broader Maine, in Bangor. But I really saw like a very strong and beautiful queer community come out for Pride. It made a huge difference to me in just feeling like this was a place I could really love.
Yeah, that's really beautiful. I think for so many people, like, Pride is such a big deal. But I'm wondering if maybe you could quantify what is it about Pride for, you know, maybe the allies out there or people who don't necessarily connect to Pride in the same way.
Yeah, super fair. For me, something that was really special was seeing all the different businesses and organizations represented. I think that if your organization has a booth at Pride, with a few perhaps exceptions, I think that shows that, you know, your business is a queer communal spot. And so it was really special to see also queer organizations. I did not know we had a roller derby league. That was very exciting news for me. A lot of different community spaces, organizations that do a lot of mutual aid in the community. I felt like it was also an opportunity for people to share resources and kind of get to know each other and get to know the people in your community that might be there to help if they're going through a rough time, or to help you if you're going through a rough time. And I think that's also what queer community building is about, is creating that network of support.
Just to expand on that idea of community and support, I was wondering if you might be able to paint us a picture of what your vision of a more queer-friendly future might look like.
I think a queer-friendly future to me looks, first of all, like a society where questioning gender and sexuality is really normalized, and maybe even just like baked into the process of life and living, especially like changing identities. I think definitely something that I've experienced in myself is a facet of internalized homophobia, where I've been really conflicted about changing my queer identity. And that really got a lot easier when I saw that modeled in other people, when I saw people changing their own identities, transitioning and detransitioning, just generally being flexible and really celebrating the way that queerness gives us a new way to look at the world. So yeah, I can imagine a really beautiful future where, you know, labels are really just for our own individual benefit, and the opportunity for change and self-definition and redefinition is possible and is celebrated.
I totally agree with that. I really think the idea of, yeah, just queerness being like a lens to see the world is something I definitely agree with. And I'm wondering, you know, kind of just honing in a little bit more on Maine, like what exactly would that future look like right here in the state of Maine?
I think maybe to narrow that down, my hopes for a queer future in Maine would be taking all of the things that make Maine really strong, including our communities and the way we stand up for each other, and kind of furthering that in incorporating queer identities into that sort of sense of community. I have heard so many stories, very powerful stories of people helping each other, especially in, you know, like really, really rural parts of Maine where people really do rely on their neighbors and their friends. And I know that oftentimes discrimination, whether you're queer or you have a different race or cultural background or just difference in general, can put you in a really tenuous position because it's less about being in reciprocity with your neighbors and more about relying on them to deem you worthy of the help when you need it. So what I hope is that in Maine and all over the world, queer people are really welcomed into communities and incorporated in communities in a robust way, not just kind of accepting, but actually really being part of the community. And in that way, kind of bringing out what I think is really special about Maine and Maine community.
Thank you so much for that insight. And it's very crazy to say, but we are nearly at the end of this episode. So I always just like to save space and leave some openness for my guests to share any final thoughts. So if you have any final thoughts or things that you would like to say, now is the time to do so.
Yeah, I really appreciate this show. I'm so glad that we're having these conversations. I really appreciate your questions. They were all so thoughtful. I'm so excited for the rest of these interviews. I'm excited to listen to them and hear other people's experiences because really, you know, being queer is also understanding that you live in a diversity of experiences and nobody has the exact same journey as you. And that's really special. I find that really, really special. So thank you.
Thank you to today's guest, Zoe Albion, who showed us how science supports queerness and the importance of your unique perspective. Thank you also to Juniper Ginger, a local artist in Maine who created our theme music. And that is all for We Are Queer. My name is Olivia Peruk, and we'll be back next month. We Are Queer happens every second Thursday of the month at 4:30 p.m., and can later be streamed on the web or app. If you have feedback for the show or want to get in touch, email info@weru.org with WERQ in the subject line. Thank you for being with us, and remember to stay curious and stay kind. Stay tuned for more public affairs broadcasting.